When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Food for Thought, a podcast gabfest wherein a multiracial mix of queer writers gather around the table to talk about, just kidding, you're actually listening to my podcast, Junk. What's up? I'm Tommy Pico, and this is Junk. A Talk That Talk interview podcast wherein I ask a treasure trove of cultural luminaries about the relics, keepsakes, and rando baubles in their apartments, sussing out the stories of their junk. This week we have a really exciting episode for you. It's a Food for Thought crossover show. That's food, the number four, and thought spelled T-H-O-T for gay sluts who love to read. It happens to be the other podcast that I co-host. So today our guests are Fran Tirado, Joseph Osmondson, and Dennis Norris II, Nobody's Junior. Fran Tirado is a writer, editor, queer community maker, glitter evangelist, and tourist the explorer extraordinaire.
Fran Tirado.
Yes, Tommy.
Will you show me your junk?
Am I ready for this phase in our relationship? I'm not sure. So this is a card that my sister gave me. You can't see it, but it is hand-stitched with like a, it's like normal paper, but it's hand-stitched with a needle and thread. Very poorly done, I will say. Like it looks like murderer handwriting.
Yeah, it looks like murder or like doctor.
Yeah, or like doctor. And it says on the front, "You're the motherfucking comeback kid." And it's kind of cheeky and funny. Like it looks funny and weird. And I have it sitting on my mantle at all times, in my bedroom, because it came to me at a time where I did not feel like anything like a comeback kid. I did not feel any sort of like high. I didn't feel good at all when I got this card. The last year was a really tough one for me, in large part because of obvious reasons. Queer and marginalized people are having a tough time in this country right now, but also for a lot of personal reasons, a lot of like mental health reasons, a lot of work reasons. It was just really hard for me to be there for anybody. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know it at the time, but my sister had a really, really tough year at the same time that I did as well. She was going through a breakup. She was going through health issues. She was going through all these different things that I didn't really know about. And I didn't know about them because I didn't ask.
Are you close?
My sister and I have a weird, we are close when we see each other, but my sister and I are still a little distance because, I mean, we're extremely similar and have the exact same sense of humor. We have the exact same approaches to life in some ways, but she's an evangelical Christian.
Oh, okay.
And so has like a slightly different viewpoint on
slightly
different life. And that doesn't necessarily separate our ideologies. Like, she's an amazing person and we get along just fine, but does create a little bit of distance between us, especially in the way that I came out. Like when I came out to my family, my sister took it the hardest and she didn't speak to me for like weeks.
Oh, wow.
We lived in the same house at the time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. She didn't speak to me for weeks. So our relationship has been, you know, in repair ever since. Mm. And I separate myself from my family kind of intentionally. I have a really hard time reaching out to them or being present for them in
general.
Girl,
same.
I mean, it's hard.
It is. It really is. And to maybe you're like this as well, but I'm so much too in the moment.
Yeah.
That it's sometimes hard for me to remember people on the other side of the country.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm very like out of sight, out of mind kind of girl. And with my sister specifically, she had a really tough year and I had no idea because And I couldn't really be there for her. I couldn't be there for anybody. Mm-hmm. Like my closest friends or like people in my circles, let alone someone who was living in Chicago, you know, thousands of miles away.
Because it sounds like you were even having a hard time being there for yourself.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you can't be there for yourself, how in the hell are you going to be there for somebody else?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's kind of what we're experiencing. And I didn't really find out about a lot of the things that happened to her until much after the fact. And by that point, it was too late. She was really hurt and she was really sad that I wasn't there for her, because she looks up to me immensely, and I know that. So it was kind of on me to reach out to my sister and to be there for her. The point of that story is that like we had really tough years, and the outcome of that was a phone call with my sister wherein she told me why she was really upset and said that she was gonna have a hard time forgiving me. And was very honest about it and explained why. And that was kind of the end of the phone call. Didn't have any sort of resolution. Mm-hmm. She was just mad. Mm-hmm. And I felt really shitty. And so maybe like 6 months later, I had just left my job at an ad agency. I was trying to figure out my finances. I was trying to figure out how to make this podcast, Food for Thought. I was trying to figure out how to balance all of my various projects and still have a steady income. And I was not succeeding. Mm-hmm. I was like financially very unwell. Mm-hmm. I was like calling my parents and seeing if I could borrow money. Like I was like cashing my coin jar at the bank, like all of those little steps, those desperate steps, like selling my clothes at Beacon's Closet. Like I was doing everything.
For like $5.
Yeah, for like literally $5. Like I was just in the worst.
Oh, I've been there. At the lean times, that's when my friends were calling me Povertebes.
Yes,
yeah. Yeah. I was selling That's everything. So like one of the reasons why I'm pretty lean in terms of junk right now is because I sold everything.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. But I know that stage of like desperation where you're just like, everything must go. Mm-hmm. Like giant signs, 50% off. Like that's how I was feeling very desperate, very out of control. And when you're a Taurus is out of control, it's just not cute. And so around Christmas time, actually it wasn't during Christmas. It was probably like late November or early December. So it wasn't even like a Christmas moment. Mm-hmm. But I get this card in the mail. And I wasn't expecting it because, again, it wasn't Christmas. It wasn't like there was nothing that prompted it. I had not spoken to my sister any time recently. But I had spoken to my parents and had told them like my grievances. And mm-hmm. I guess my parents told my sister mm-hmm. about what was going on with me. And I open up the card and I see the hand-stitched "You're the motherfucking comeback kid" on the front of this card, and I immediately start crying. Because this line, "You're the motherfucking comeback kid," is the final line in a very raunchy poem I wrote about gay sex 8.5 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And
This is a deep cut.
I actually still like the poem, honestly. It's a really cute poem, even though it's not representative of my work now. But the whole poem is about
in the juvenilia.
Right,
later
exactly.
On. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the whole poem is like obviously about coming back, but also about like revenge. Going high when they go low. Mm-hmm. And it was a poem that my parents never read my poetry. It was too raunchy for them. It was too like secular for them. My sister never read my poetry either, or so I thought. And so I guess my sister had found the poem on my Tumblr or on my website or something and had kept it for 8 years.
And had never told you?
And never told me that she had ever read it 8 years ago. And I had just no idea that she had even consumed my work, because when I'm around my parents or my sister, I'm so ashamed of it. Because I grew up conservative.
Right. And that there's like some kind of division between the person you are in New York and the person you are when you're back home. And it's almost like the idea of those things mixing. It's not a transgression, but it's not something that you expect.
Exactly. And I think I was taken aback and I thought maybe it was just a coincidence. And then I opened up the card and it says, "Hey, Fran man, I once read this really awesome poem," which had a line that kept popping into my head when I heard about your financial situation. "I'm so sorry. I just got a Christmas bonus, so I hope that this helps." And inside of the card was a $250 check.
Oh, wow.
From my sister, who is 3 years younger than me.
No shame.
And I cried even more. And I think... The big thing about this, the reason I have this card sitting in my mantle is because I constantly tell myself that I'm a monster. Mm-hmm. I play into the caricature of monster frequently because it gets me what I want, or it helps me along in my various jobs, or it helps me just have a better work ethic or whatever. Mm-hmm. I constantly think of myself as this like emotionless monster who's just very adamant about getting what he needs.
Especially in New York, that is extremely advantageous.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And New York has hardened me to that mindset, unfortunately. And when I wasn't there for my sister at a time that she needed me, I kind of let it wash off my back in the same way. Mm. I was kind of like, it's okay. I'm a monster anyways. Like, this is expected of me. I'm not a good person.
Right. And if you're like rewarded for that behavior, or like it doesn't really have that many consequences. I mean, because in New York, everything is moving so quickly. You don't have as many emotional ties. It's not like they're family. And yeah. So if they do have a problem with it, you never hear about it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Maybe you get a subtweet every now and then, but yeah. It doesn't really come back to you the
same
way.
Out of sight, out of mind, exactly. And I think I had just resolved to being this nasty thing. And despite me not being there for my sister, despite me not being a very good brother, years later, my sister still reached back out to me and extended this very human, very beautiful gesture that a monster is not really worthy of. Mm. And so this card kind of reminds me that I'm not a monster, that I don't have to be one, and that there are reasons why people in my life don't think I'm one too.
Yeah.
Even though I'm constantly trying to play that version of my caricature.
Thank you so much, Brian.
No problem, Tommy.
Joseph Osmondson is a scientist, nonfiction writer, verse crop top, anal lingerer, and the softest bowl of soft serve you'll ever meet.
Okay, well, I want to note that prior to recording this, Joseph did not show me. So I'm getting the reveal at the same time that everybody else is.
Teebs has never seen my junk.
So, Joseph Osmondson.
Yes.
Will you show me your junk?
Yes, baby, I will. So, I have a weird relationship to my junk because, you know, in New York, we don't have space. There's just no space to hoard shit. Mm-hmm. And my parents live in a big house in the country, but my mom is like an anti-junk manifesto,
okay,
if you will.
Okay,
and
I
so
will.
She like gets rid of shit all the time. And she kept sending me all my stuff, mm-hmm, like stuff that I want to keep, like baby books and yearbooks and stuff that I'm going to want when I'm old.
Well, you really do. Okay, so you're going to want those things later.
I'm going to want those things, but I don't have space for them.
Right.
So I have one box that's like a giant junk drawer, and it is only things that are very dear to me. So it's been very tightly curated already. And I brought two pieces of junk.
Ooh, okay.
From the same era of my life.
You're going to DP me with some junk, huh?
I am going to stick all of my junk inside you. The first one is short
trash
and quick, and it's like totally not functional, which is why it's like the best junk, but I'll never, ever get rid of it. It is a broken TI-83
wow
calculator that I got, that we were forced to buy freshman year of high school.
Yeah, I remember.
I played nibbled on that shit like a motherfucker.
This is back in the day for all you kids out there, for all you Generation Z or whatever. All I knew from this calculator was I knew how to make it say boobless when you turned it upside down.
Yes. And I was in the back of class playing Nibbles. But I
what's Nibbles?
Nibbles, it's like a game where you have a snake and you have to eat little pixels on the screen.
All
right. And so you just move it around the screen. So
we were very easy to entertain back in the day. We didn't really need that much.
I mean, you didn't have that much, so like I lived in the country. And my parents were like, no video games for you. But I always say, and I've said this on the other podcast we do, that mathematics was my first access to the sublime. Mm-hmm. So the calculator actually sitting by myself in my room doing math homework and learning kind of the more advanced mathematics that you would need, you know, a graphing calculator for, and playing. It was play. It's like put in different formulas and see the shapes that they make. That was
You're
really
disgusting.
I know. I'm so sorry. And so the other thing from that
Wait, can I ask you though, mm-hmm, why have you kept this?
And it's totally not functional. It literally just is a memory that brings me back to the moment when I first learned that problem solving felt transcendent to me.
And I'm just interested because it's not enough to have the moment, but to have the object to remember the moment by.
Teebs, you know that feeling? I went into the junk drawer, and I don't go in there very often. It's at the bottom of my closet now. So it's this box. And I went in there, and I pulled a bunch of stuff out. But when I pulled this out, I just smiled. sort of involuntarily.
All right.
I do think about that time in my life, and I think about the access that books and mathematics and learning gave me to escape myself and to escape my body. Mm-hmm. I think about that often, but the object sort of brings it back in a way that the memories don't hold by themselves.
Well, it makes it impossible to escape.
Right, right, right. Well, I mean, I could have thrown it away, right? And then in which case, I wouldn't have that sort of reaction.
When what part of you would you be throwing away?
Oh, Teebs. Uh-huh. A trash monster, middle school smelly jerkwad. My other piece of trash is of junk.
Because junk
trash.
Is not trash. Just,
it's from
you
that
know,
same
put
era.
It out there.
Pre-digital camera, I took a photography class. So I wanted to bring a math thing and a photography and an art thing. And I thought I was going to be a photographer because I was like, it's like science, but art. And so these are prints that I shot and developed myself.
I just have to say, like, for the people who cannot see this, this is a humongous, what would you
portfolio.
Call
portfolio.
Portfolio. All
they
right, that's
are
what you're calling it. Okay.
So bad.
$30. Okay, they're, so Joe's so put
once,
prices
so,
on all of these
sold
pictures.
I once sold them. Here, these are actually the only ones that I like. These are black and whites that I took long on a tripod with long exposures of fireworks.
These are all fireworks pictures, by the way.
So those I really like. Here's a picture of a kid I knew rollerblading.
Okay,
he's doing a jump. I caught him midair.
This is a picture of a blader.
This is a picture of a chair. Okay. It was so artsy. It was so bad.
And I got to say, too, so Joseph has priced these at between $25 and $35.
This had to be in the 90s, though, so that was a lot of money. So that's all. But I also mounted some.
We will absolutely post these for the audience at home. In this whirlwind picture that I'm looking at right now, it is a barking dog who's in a tizzy of some sort.
She's chasing a ball. She's about to catch the ball in her mouth. There's about to be balls in her mouth. In my
junk. I see the open mouth. I see the bouncy. I see the tennis ball.
Yep. Yep.
Otherwise, you know, this is like one of those magic eye pictures. I don't really know.
Are you ready for the best one?
Okay.
The big reveal. So this was an assignment we had to do a double exposure, and I brought lights home. I rented them from the school, and it took
so
a picture
you were
of
so
a, of
serious
a friend.
I was, about this.
No, that's the whole point. That's why I find these so endearing, and why I can't get rid of them, because they're so bad, but I thought they were so good, and I was so serious about it. Look at that.
Wow.
That is a view from the deck in my house.
That's
and so it's
good.
Just a bunch of trees. And then I took put lights in my basement and set up a studio, and I took a menacing picture of a man, and I sort of placed him like God over my backyard. And it's a very corny sort of like sci-fi sort of thing.
So this picture that Joe has taken and manipulated, I want to point out it's like a God face in the middle of like a forest.
Yes.
And I see that as being, for example, on like a bookmark at like a Christian bookstore. And it says like, "Oh Lord, my God, and I, an awesome wonder, consider all the world thy hands have made."
I think it was meant to be menacing, so it was meant to be more like,
why
have you forsaken me moment.
Yeah, okay.
Like, why are you punishing me so as a proto-homosexual? I think that's sort of what it is. But I these two things kind of go together for me, because I wanted both ever since I was little. I wanted to be an artist. And I wanted to be a scientist or mathematician. They both allowed me to access things in myself that I really loved. But I was really bad at photography. And so I just love that little guy. That little guy who worked so hard on something and thought he was doing great.
And you are... this is how I know we're close, because you are willing to trot these out for me. And
you know I have no shame.
Okay, but the other thing
is... Do you
is,
follow
like,
me
who,
on Twitter?
Okay, but who the fuck is good at anything in middle school?
Right, no,
you know what I mean?
True.
Middle school, high school, whatever. Like, I could trot some stuff out for you right now, but I won't, because I destroyed all that like everybody else did.
Like, all normal
with
people.
Motherfucking
Whereas
sense.
It's like the one thing that I have put away in this tiny box of things. I've thrown away like 95% of the things from that time of my life, but for whatever reason, these like early attempts at art, I just don't want to get rid of.
This message comes from iHeartRadio sponsor Mercury Insurance. If you're looking to save some money, you should really think about getting a quote from Mercury, because Californians save an average of $677 with Mercury. It's quick and easy, and in just a few minutes, you might find you could save a lot of money on your auto and home insurance. Plus, Mercury was named one of America's best insurance companies by Insure.com 4 years in a row. Low rates, big discounts, great insurance. Go to MercuryInsurance.com today to get a quote.
It's crazy how much we have to pay for outdated, impersonal healthcare, and even crazier that we all just accept it. It's time to face facts. Healthcare is backwards. Luckily, there's Forward, a new approach to primary care that's surprisingly personal and refreshingly straightforward. Forward never makes you feel like just another patient. Backed by top-rated doctors and the latest tech, Forward gives you access to personalized care whenever you need it. Using in-depth genetic analysis and real-time blood work, Forward's top-rated doctors provide you with in-depth insights to better understand your genetics, mental, and physical health. They then create custom, easy-to-understand plans to help guide you to achieving long-term health. With Forward, you get unlimited in-person visits with your doctor and access to care anytime via the Forward app, all for one flat monthly fee. It's time to stop accepting backwards healthcare and start moving your health forward. Visit GoForward.com today to learn more. That's GoForward.com.
At Capella University, education is as smart as the world around us. With the FlexPath format, you can take classes at your own pace, set your own deadlines, and even leverage your previous experience to move faster. Now that's smart. Learn more at Capella.edu.
Hey, I'm Gabrielle Collins, period drama nerd, and your behind-the-scenes guide to Bridgerton. On Bridgerton, the official podcast, we're learning how this fantasy world dipped in history came to life.
Daphne, her costume design really is about the elegance of simplicity. It's just color and shape.
We went old school and we got two scenic artists in who painted the backings for us by hand.
These dukes are all like in their late 20s, early 30s. Almost all of them are unmarried, really good looking. And none of them have syphilis.
Can you imagine when he looks into your eyes and then he dips you?
We just heard this sort of ripping sound. Yep, I think there's just been a wardrobe malfunction.
Listen to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere you get your favorite shows.
For whatever reason, though, I think you know the reason there.
Yeah, I love that little child. I love his attempts and his earnestness, and that he just found it joyful.
And there is also what I'm understanding in this boldness, and the boldness of doing this and mounting this and signing
selling them
and selling them, is that there is like a confidence to that person that like they aren't jaded.
Yeah,
there's no reason for them to question themselves. Why would they do that? Because they're doing something that they really like. And of course, like, this is kind of what, like, it's like the way in which you pattern yourself after people who you idolize as a child. Yeah. And you're just kind of like, oh, this is how we do things, right? Yeah.
This was a person who hadn't yet learned imposter syndrome, because I hadn't yet been out of my little town where everyone was the same. I mean, we were all poor. I was nerdy, so I was kind of bullied, but like there was no reason to be an imposter around these people. I felt special there in a way that as soon as I learned how big the world was outside of that place, I lost that feeling of specialness.
Can I ask you, have you kept all of your photographs, or these are the only ones?
These are
that
the
you
only
kept?
Ones from these are the ones that I went into a dark room and printed myself. So, I also like them for that reason, that this is a technology that essentially no one really uses anymore. And it's something that I learned how to do. And I was really proud of that at the time, that I knew how to go into a dark room and do this really hard thing.
Mm. Would you say, like Lydia Dietz said at the time, your life was a dark room?
Oh, bitch.
I don't want to belabor this point any further, but the way that I'm seeing, I also at a certain time in my childhood, I'll call it high school years or whatever, like I was also really attracted to photography.
Yeah.
And I did develop stuff as well, and I showed it to people and I hung it on my wall, like later people would come through and laugh at me. Rightly so.
Yeah.
But I'm curious if you see anything in queerness or anything in otherness in it's almost like, I don't want to say it this way, but I'm going to say it this way. It's almost like not participating in the world, but looking at the world.
It's voyeurism. Yeah, I was literally just going to say that. So the one series that I don't have, because it was literally bought for $250, which was so much money to me back then, by the superintendent of my school, the entire Arlington, Washington schools. It was a series I did for my final project.
Did you report that income?
Yes, tax man, I did. So there were these photos that I took of kids at a food festival. So it was all these like all these images of like
I find that so funny.
of children experiencing the joy of a new taste. And it's capturing, I mean, that's what photography, you know, Sontag has that beautiful book on photography that she says it allows us to capture these moments. And that it, actually those moments are a lie in a way. Those moments are,
oh, for sure.
You know, so, yeah. But it allows us to see and not be seen and to capture someone else's joy and to sort of inhabit their joy in a way that I think is very typical for young queer people. It's hard to sort of imagine having that moment yourself. And as someone who felt very outside of lots of types of joy at that time in my life, having that way to access it and keep it and call it my own and keep the image and put it up on my wall or put it into a book sort of allowed me to own the joy of others, I guess.
So then in a way, like keeping this particular junk, keeping these photographs is kind of like a testament to how far you've come as a person who observed moments of joy to a person who can partake in moments of joy. Yeah.
But, and it also is a reminder to never lose that the innocence and the earnestness of the child that I was, to hold on to transcend what I wasn't, but to hold on to what I was.
And being one of the softest people that I know, Joe, I don't think you're going to have a problem with
aww,
that.
Aw, baby.
Dennis Norris II, nobody's junior, is a writer, reader, former figure skater, lapsed violist, and around-the-way girl.
My neck, my back, my pussy, and my crack.
Here we go.
Yes.
Dennis Norris II, nobody's junior.
Woo!
Will you show me your junk?
Girl, all I want to do is show you my junk.
Ay, ay, ay.
Okay. So,
What am I looking at here?
Okay. So you're looking at a picture in a beautiful sort of silver frame. I gotta give you the history. And the picture is a picture of me. It's actually four pictures in one, kind of, of me at what turned out to be my last figure skating competition.
Oh.
This was my last figure skating competition of my competitive skating career. I was, I think, 15. Mm-hmm. And in the picture, there's one larger picture of me in the opening pose for my routine.
Oh, this isn't Pledge Allegiance? Because you have your hand over your heart like you're pledging allegiance.
I do. Bag. That's exactly what it looks like. And okay. It was actually just the opening pose of my choreography.
Gotcha.
And then three other photos of me at different moments in my routine. And I'm in the costume. I was skating to the soundtrack from the movie Henry V.
A regular Shakespeare.
Yes. Oh my God. I can't even. And it looks very Shakespearean. I'm in this like costume with puffed sleeves and like a velvet vest, and it's all very gay and very figure skatey. And so, yeah, that's the picture. That's what you're looking at.
And it says Skate Chautauqua 2002.
Yes.
Okay.
Girl, Skate Chautauqua.
Whatever. I don't know how to pronounce things.
I always like to tell people, like, if you remember that moment when Tara Lipinski won the Olympics and she like screamed and jumped up and down and like looked crazy in the kiss and cry because she won the Olympics. That was my reaction when I won Skate Chautauqua.
will you tell us what the kiss and cry is?
So the kiss and cry is that area when you watch a figure skating competition where after the skater has finished their program and they step off the ice, their coach hands them their guards and they walk over to the kiss and cry, which is the area where you receive your scores. Mm-hmm. You wait for your scores, you receive your scores, and you will often kiss your coaches on the cheek. That used to be a formality thing that would happen in figure skating, and you'd cry if you didn't do well. You'd kiss if you did well. You'd cry if you didn't do well. Mm. So they call it the kiss and cry.
Sounds like a Seal song, to be honest with you. Anyway, will you tell me a little bit more of the significance of this picture? I mean, I just have to say that there is no bone in my body that is surprised that the junk of Dennis Norris II, nobody's junior, is a picture of themselves in a beautiful silver frame, as they say.
I mean, it's true. I love myself. The reason why I picked this item, you know, I grew up in this really conservative religious family where being gay was like an issue. Coming out of the closet as a gay person was a huge issue for us. My father was a prominent minister. My mom was really devout and even more so in some ways than him. And growing up, I'd known that I liked boys since I was in like kindergarten or first grade.
And obviously, you know, you were doing figure skating, elite figure skating. I assume they also knew that you liked boys or no?
Well, when I came out, they were like, well, we're not surprised, but we would, you know, we would love to like maybe send you to reparative therapy or have you talk to someone.
Oh, snap.
I said no, and they were okay with that, but that
I did not know that, and I've known you for a minute now.
Yeah.
Reparative therapy, is that what they're calling it?
They asked if they could send me to it, and I was like, no. I was like, this is not going to be a boy erased situation. Shout out to Gerard Conley. I was like, I'm not doing that. They even wanted to try and hook me up, like have me meet with Donnie McClurkin, So Donnie McClurkin is a prominent gospel singer who was gay and claims to now not be gay. It's a lie.
Uh-huh.
But that's what they claim.
As anyone like, who is familiar with them would know.
Basically. Yeah. And so the reason why this picture is really important to me is because at the time at which I was figure skating, I'm so glad that participating in the sport came into my life when it did, because I was figuring out my sexuality. I was in the process of coming out. I came out right actually around the time that this picture was taken,
okay,
maybe 2 months after it.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was in August of 2002. And I came out, I think, in December of 2002.
Okay.
So the reason why this picture is really important to me is that years later, when I was in college, and my relationship with my family in some ways was kind of fractured for a long time. And when I was in college, I was home for the holidays, and my dad was an interim pastor of this church. And so he had an office in the church. And so I was just there, and I went into his office. And on his desk in this big office, there were pictures of our entire family, but one of the pictures of me was this photo.
Oh, okay.
And it meant so much to me because I have for a long time really struggled with the idea of whether or not my father is proud of me. Mm-hmm. And I had at that point too.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have put a picture of me doing all kinds of things on his desk.
Mm-hmm.
He could have put a picture of me playing the viola in an orchestra concert or a recital. He could have put like a class picture.
Or a photoshopped you butching it up, maybe.
That is, I don't, well.
There is not software.
Can I really?
It does not exist. Dennis Norris II, nobody's junior.
Adobe has not created that program yet. But it meant the world. I wasn't even figure skating at that point. Like I think I was a junior or a senior in college, but it meant so much to me to see that this picture, which I had forgotten about,
mm-hmm,
was not only present, but it was on his desk. It was like close to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so a few years later, my father passed away pretty suddenly. And that's like a complicated thing that I'm working through in my fiction and I'm working through in my life. Even though at this point he's been gone for 7.5 years,
mm-hmm,
like, those things change you forever. But at some point after he passed, maybe like a couple years later, I was home with my sister and we were doing something that we always do when we go home. We always make some time to do this because my dad was like a very organized hoarder. So we go through boxes and boxes of like old things. And so we'd come across
your dad's junk.
We would go through my dad's junk, and there's plenty of it. And so we came across some boxes of items that he had moved when he left that job, moved back home. And I saw this picture wrapped very carefully in cellophane. And so it was also very clear that it had been packaged lovingly and with the intent to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing that brought back that memory of walking into his office and seeing this picture and this representation of this part of me that at that moment was so long forgotten that I wouldn't have even thought about the idea that my parents would like remember it or think of it. And it was also a representation of me at a time that was really difficult in our relationship and in our lives.
Right.
And it was there. And so I remembered all of that, all that feeling, all that emotion came kind of flooding back to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I'm going to take this picture, and it's always going to be in my home and in my apartment. And so usually it is there. But actually, a few years ago, I started working at an organization that works with figure skaters. And so now it's on my desk at my office.
Right. As a way, so you're doing something similar that your father did, which is like showing you off in a way.
Yes.
That, yeah, but in a way that, like, I think it sounds like it was really reparative.
That's exactly, I think, the way to look at it. It was reparative. It was just one moment where I remember knowing with a lot of certainty that my father was proud of me.
Yeah.
And when I say I struggle with that, like, when I was a kid and I was, like, playing, you know, classical music and I was figure skating, whenever I got out either on the ice to compete, usually at the start of the warm-up session, or whenever I took the stage as part of an orchestra, the first thing I would do while I was warming up was try to find my parents and find where they were sitting. Mm-hmm. And just, like, see them. And they knew that I did that, and they would, you know, kind of wave or smile or whatever. Just to know that they were there, it always made me feel comfortable. And so I kind of moved through the world that way. And so when I came out of the closet, and it felt like maybe they weren't going to be proud of me anymore, I internalized that in a really serious way. And this was a moment where I found relief from that when I saw this picture that time.
Can I ask you a question? And feel free to not answer if it's, like, too difficult. Mm-hmm. But what was it like going through your father's junk that first time? Because as somebody, like, because I'm interested in people who are either organized or disorganized hoarders. You know what I mean? And the people who actively sort of accumulate their like, referential junk around them, whether or not, like, it's, like, even functional anymore, right?
Yeah.
What do you remember thinking, or do you remember anything, like, flooding you as you were going through it?
So the thing about losing your dad when you're on the younger side of life, I was 24 when that happened, or losing any parent or anyone that's older than you, is that, like, I like, thought I knew a lot about my dad. You know, growing up, you kind of think you know a lot about your parents because you live with them and they're raising you. But as you begin to be an adult and you go through so many things, I think you begin to realize, or I began to realize, that there were so many things about my parents that I didn't know, that I wouldn't know. And because as a kid, you're not concerned with that.
When you're a younger person, you only ever see them as the caretaker, as your parent, as that sort of something godly in a way.
Yep. And as that role changes, that's when you begin to see them differently. And so I, especially because this was at the beginning of me really seriously pursuing a writing career, so a lot of the inquisitiveness that I have now, I didn't necessarily have when I was 21, you know, or 22. And so I just remember going through all kinds of things and finding, like, receipts from the 60s or love letters that he wrote my mom when he was courting her, or, like, cassette tape recordings of sermons that he delivered in the 70s.
Wow.
All kinds of things. Pictures that didn't make it into all of our family, like, photo books of my, like, my sisters when they were kids in the 70s or the 80s. And so I felt like I began to get a better sense of the quiet moments of my father's life, moments that wouldn't necessarily make it into the narrative that you're presenting your kids about your past, like, things that had nothing to do with, like, where he went to college or what he majored in, things that are just like, oh, like, one time he, like, went to this gas station that doesn't exist anymore, or one time, or whatever. You just find these, like, bits of information. And it was interesting because I didn't find this the very first time I did that. I found it maybe the second or third, but I found one thing that was really wild was that I found the sermon that my father was writing when he had the stroke that he died from.
Oof.
It had not been moved from the pile of stuff that it was under on our dining room table, which is where he was sitting when he was writing that sermon. And that sermon had a title, and the title was When the Harvest Comes. And when I saw that, I was like, oh, that's the title of my novel. Mm. Like, now I have the title of my novel. Mm. So you just, I learned so much. It was almost as though I felt like my parents had been these, like a penciled shaving of each other. Like, that's what they were in my head.
Right.
And when I go through this information, their image has texture,
yeah,
and color and personality. There's like whimsy. Mm-hmm. So it brings things that happened long before they ever thought of me to life.
Mm. And that's some trippy shit. I remember, mm-hmm. I remember one time my brother, he was very, very little, and he was taking a walk with my parents. And I think he was like pointing out something, and they were like, "Oh, that was there before you were born." And he was like, "But I was always born."
Oh my God,
but
it's
such
that.
A cute
I
thing
love
for a kid
that.
To think. But that's the way you do think. Like, of course, I've always been here. And so it sounds like what you got vis-a-vis going through your father's junk was a portrait of the person in their quieter moments, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what I got. And I think that still holds true to, I think, why I'm still working on the novel that I'm working on, which deals with a man that is sort of in his place in my head, is because I think when you're working on work that's related to someone that you've lost, working on that work is a way of holding on to them.
Oh,
and
for
once
sure.
you finish it and you move Woo. On. Alex said this on an episode of Food for Thought when he was in the studio with us, Alexander Chi, the novelist. And when he said that, it hit me so hard because I have been so frustrated with myself because I'm not finished yet. And I was just like, oh, there's some deeper shit connected to this too.
Because not only are you still holding on to this person who you're grieving, but then you're also giving him up and he mm-hmm. doesn't belong. That character doesn't belong to you anymore. Then
right.
it all of a sudden belongs to your audience.
Yeah. There's a whole thing about writing that I think about, which is just this idea that it's a very generous act of love. I think if you're doing it in the right way, but regardless of that, it's something that you're giving to an audience that you have held close to you and protected.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it has been exclusive to you in this way for however long that you've been working on it.
But I would like to think of it this way, if I may. Mm. When you found your junk in the box and you said it was wrapped in cellophane as in something to be dealt with carefully and protected,
mm-hmm.
right? But that taking it out of the cellophane, putting it on the desk, putting it out in the world
yeah.
was then a way of like reflecting. It was a way of appreciating it, the junk, but then also mm-hmm. Sharing that appreciation with other people. And I do think that's what you're going to be doing with your writing as well.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for that junk, D.
Thank you.
Oh, my God. Ah, thank you for that story, Dennis. Next up, I'm going to read a section from my book, Junk, ending the show as I always do. And just for a little bit of context, a breakup has just happened. The cover is up to our shoulders. We lay in the couch bed of our preconceptions, separating. Not a steady walk back to the land where I don't know you. Took you long fucking enough. Now I'm stupid and sugar-free and frothing. The only thing harder than writing is quitting candy. And the only thing harder than quitting candy is walking all day and buttering to bed in my body. But now that I'm fully inhabiting my cement, I'm closer to the sacral joy of thinking into my rib cage. Convention says a book should be this long, but I'm only interested in writing as long as you want to read in one sitting. My aura is a strawberry shortcake dessert bar and the popular American corn snack Funyuns. My safe word is go to hell, Katy Perry, pronounced Caddy. I'm writing a sitcom about butts and counting. It's called Number Two. The tagline is turn the other cheek. Most times, I'm a maniac. Other times, losing an arm wrestling match. Sitting for longer and longer, but paying less and less attention. Evolutionarily, is a load easier to swallow with we, as in we've known for centuries that time is a bossy bird curdler, protrude from the green and calling it bud?
Sometimes you need to read something more than once. My joint is Mary Jane. The theme is harmony of a gradient. Let's hold hands and walk to the water taxi and match in tank tops. But we call the tank tops wedges. And the wedges are a chip witch. And our cherry cokes are a summer afternoon where we can't do nothing but lean into the grass at the carousel park in Dumbo with the lap of the river and the dollhouse of Lower Manhattan face fucking us while we neck and later face fuck.
Feeling piqued, roused, amused? Buy the book online or at a fine or frankly trashy bookshop near you. Junk is produced by Alexandra DePalma with production assistance by Kenya Anderson. Kenya, tell the good folks where to find you.
Hi, folks.
What's up? It's Kenya, and I'd like to give a shout out to my Instagram. It's at Kenya Diggit Teebs. Will you do a dramatic reading for the
it's
people?
At @KENYA_DIGG_IT. I'm Tommy Pico, and you can find me in hell. Our theme music is a cover of Fotos y Recuerdos by Downtown Boys. Thanks for letting us use it. And you can follow us on Instagram to see pics of all the junk we mentioned in this episode at Junk Podcast. We're brought to you each week by the publisher So Hot It's Like Fahrenheit 69 in this bitch, Tin House Books. Thanks for sticking around. Stay good.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.